It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Republican leaders of Wisconsin's Assembly and Senate say they're open to the idea of limited medical marijuana here in the state. We'll find out how states around the country handle their programs and what options may be on the table here in Wisconsin. First, inflation appears to be slowing down after the Consumer Price Index showed inflation declining from the 7.1% rate in November to 6.5% in December. That's generally seen as good-ish news for the economy, but the Federal Reserve is still hoping to see inflation drop to 2% or so. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What does inflation look like to you? Have you seen improvements in things that are important to you that you spend money on regularly? What questions do you have about inflation, efforts to deal with it, possible impacts on the rest of the economy? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Kenneth West is the John D. MacArthur Professor of Economics at UW-Madison. Ken, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, of course. It's a pleasure.
Let's start with this news, the inflation numbers for December. Some improvement. I don't think anybody ran out and danced in the streets for it. How big a deal is it, though, that we're seeing at least some decline in inflation?
Well, Rob, in fact, we're seeing a kind of persistent decline in inflation. You mentioned that the annual inflation rate over the last 12 months has been 6.5%. That's kind of an average of in the first 6 months of the last year was very high, 8 or 9%. The last 6 months, it's been lower, 3 or 4%. You average those out, you get to the 6.5% that you mentioned. So inflation has really been very relatively moderate for the last 3 months, last 6 months, 3 to 4%. As you say, the Fed is hoping to get it down to 2%. So they don't consider their job done yet. But the 6.5 is a little misleading.
Yeah, how so? What might be a better way to look at that number?
Well, I think you can split into the trend. As I say, the trend is coming down. The 6.5 is an accurate figure, but what matters is not only the level, but the trend. And as I say, the trend is inflation's falling. A year ago, it was 8 or 9%. The past few months, it's been less than 2%. And in fact, in December, the most recent month that the data are available, inflation actually fell very slightly, -0.1%. That doesn't mean it's going to keep falling. There's a lot of month-to-month variation in the numbers. It does mean that's an optimistic sign that we're moving in the right direction from very high inflation, moving down to moderate inflation. And as you say, the Fed is hoping to get us down to low inflation. We're kind of at 3% now, roughly 3 to 4% in the last several months.
Now, I know there were some arguments about exactly what was causing that high inflation, and maybe that's part of the answer to this question. What is leading inflation to come down now?
In terms of the high inflation, there's maybe three things that have been proposed. One of them, of course, is supply chain issues that followed on the pandemic. With everything shut down, it took a long time to get things started. People weren't spending any money, and they were eager to spend it once we were kind of allowed to go out of our houses and go to restaurants and so on. There's a lot of money chasing goods. They're having a hard time arriving where the money was. So one thing is supply chain issues combined with pent-up household demand. The second is the American Rescue Plan, which in hindsight, the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan was perhaps the negative side effect of pushing up inflation. The final thing is the disruptions from the war in Ukraine. Now, in terms of those, the effects of the American Rescue Plan Act have largely died out. Supply chain issues are largely gone. The disruptions from the Ukraine war, it showed up in gas prices, oil prices, that seems to be diminishing. So on all three accounts, the federal spending, the supply chain issues, the disruptions from the Ukraine war, we seem to be in the right direction. And of course, it's not a guarantee. Something horrible could happen in the Ukraine or elsewhere. But right now, we seem to be moving in the right direction.
Now, when we say inflation overall, I think that's covering up a lot of variation. We see the price of eggs still hanging up there, in part because of avian flu. We see some prices settling down, housing costs up. I could go on all day. Where do you see inflation being stubbornly persistent? Where do you see prices coming down that's driving this decline in overall inflation?
Well, prices coming down, one that's very salient to many people is gas prices. I think the last time I bought gas here in Madison, there's going to be some variation of course across the state. I think I paid about $3.30 a gallon, something like that, $3.30, $3.40. 6 or 9 months ago, I was paying, $4.40, $4.50. I don't remember exactly. So gas prices are coming down. A major contributor to the overall inflation rate was high housing costs, high rents, and those seem to have stabilized. In fact, goods prices, cars also seem to have stabilized. Going in the opposite direction, mortgage rates have gone way up. So that's going to be tough for people trying to pay out, trying to buy houses. So on the good side, what seems to have happened is gas prices, maybe car prices. On the bad side, it kind of seems services are now, maybe picking up a little.
Talking to Ken West, economist at UW-Madison, looking at the latest news on inflation. As we've heard, trends moving in a downward direction. Good news overall for the economy. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions. Where do you see inflation affecting your own financial well-being the most? Are you noticing gas prices going down if you buy diesel? How is that looking for you? What do you see at the grocery store if you're shopping for big ticket items like cars or houses? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Ken, the Federal Reserve has been reacting to inflation for a while. They have one main tool, those interest rates that play into those mortgage rates you just mentioned. They've been doing bigger increases. What is the thinking now with these better inflation numbers about what the Federal Reserve may or may not do in the months to come?
Sure. Let's just review first of all what the Fed's thinking is, which is they control a certain overnight rate used just within the banking system. It's a rate that neither you nor I nor any of your listeners would have access to. But all interest rates are connected, and when they raise this intra-bank rate, that kind of raises all the interest rates. So 30-year mortgages are up above 6% now. A year ago, before the Fed started hiking, it was 3%. So the Fed's idea is, as they raise the interest rate that they control, that propagates through the economy, raising mortgage rates and other interest rates, and that slows down interest-sensitive spending, where housing is very interest sensitive. Now you're going to pay for a house, it's highly sensitive to what your mortgage rate is. Car buying is highly interest sensitive. One's sensitivity to the car price depends a lot on the interest rate you're paying if you're financing the car. So that's their thinking. They raise an interest rate that they control, it propagates to the economy. Spending slows down. If spending slows down, there's not as much money chasing a given amount of goods, and inflation will slow down. So that's their thinking. Now, the rates we see, like mortgage rates, as they say, are above 6%. I'm going to quote this bank rate that the Fed controls. They raised it from essentially zero to about 4%. Current thinking, including mine, consensus, is they're probably going to keep raising it. Their own prediction is they're going to keep raising it, probably at least another 0.5% over the next 6 months, maybe as much as 1%. If they do that, the rates that we face for mortgages and car loans are also going to go up. So what's going to happen? As you said, the Fed is not quite happy with inflation. They're roughly running 3%. They want it down to 2%. Probably over the coming year, they're going to raise interest rates a bit, but much less dramatically than they've raised it over the past year. Again, it went from 0 to 4. Now we're talking 4 up to 4.5, maybe 4.75%. And again, this is the interest rate that they control, which is not identical to the interest rates that we see in our mortgages and bank accounts.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Liz is with us in Hartford. Liz, hi.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I just turned on the radio and heard your guest say that gas prices are going down and prices are stabilizing. I paid $4.99 for a dozen eggs yesterday, and I filled my tank today at $3.24 per gallon. 2 weeks ago, that was $3.09. So I'm not quite sure where your guest is from, but in Hartford, prices are not stabilizing and gas is not getting cheaper.
Liz, thanks for the call. Now, big picture, gas has gone down over a bunch of months, but Liz just hit on two things that are kind of weird to measure in inflation. Food prices and gas, those tend to be more volatile, and there are different measures of inflation that include or exclude those. Ken, can you talk about that a little?
Sure. For Liz, first of all, thanks for your question. Two comments. First of all, eggs are in a special category, so special that it's been throughout the media about what's happening to eggs. I'm not an expert on this, but as I understand it, there's been some avian flu,
exactly,
which has made the egg prices skyrocket. It's not to say it's good or something we should ignore that egg prices are going up. It's just a statement that there's something special in eggs, which probably doesn't apply to the rest of the economy. In terms of gas prices, I endorse what Rob said. Overall, they've been going down. They kind of fluctuate up and down, but the trend is clear. So Liz, certainly for me, earlier in the year, I was paying, $4.40, $4.50 a gallon. As I said, I think it was about $3.30 the last time I bought it. I understand from you that $3.10 not too long ago. $3.10 is better than $3.30, and we'd like to get it back down to $3.10. But again, to me, the trend is clear. They are broadly, gas prices are broadly coming down. I mentioned gas prices and food prices are so volatile that within the world of people who specialize in terms of thinking about inflation and thinking about monetary policy, there's another inflation rate called core inflation that simply strips out the volatile components, for example, food and gas. And in fact, the Fed is probably looking more at those than at overall inflation, because their view is no matter what they do, the gas prices are going to jump up and down and food prices are going to jump up and down. Whereas what they really affect with their interest rate hikes is things like purchases of cars and houses. Now, this core inflation measure is running roughly the same as the overall inflation measure. It's been coming down over the last year. It's also at 3-4%. For what it's worth, I mentioned that in December, the overall inflation rate had fallen by a tiny amount. In fact, the core inflation rate rose. And the difference between those, Liz and Rob and other listeners, is really gas prices. Gas prices continue to come down. And when you combine gas prices, the overall inflation rate went down. Whereas if you strip them out, as is done among economists and people who study inflation and monetary policy, overall inflation went up. So overall, the picture looks good, whether you strip out gas and food or whether you include gas or food.
Liz, thanks for calling in with the local report. I appreciate it. We're talking to Ken West, professor of economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, looking at reports showing a decrease in inflation. Federal Reserve still hoping to get it down more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about inflation slowing down? What do you see driving that? How did inflation affect your life? Are you seeing improvements, or are you in one of those challenging categories looking for a house and looking at the cost of that mortgage right now? Do you have questions about the economics of this, how it all works? Join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Ken West, professor of economics at UW-Madison, about inflation slowing down, what it means for consumers, the overall economy. Still time for you to join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. If you are a person who buys stuff, what have you seen? Have you seen some improvements in stuff that you spend money on regularly? If you're looking to buy something in particular, house, car, say, what are you seeing if you sell those things? Love to hear your side of the story, too. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ken, we keep mentioning and hearing that the Federal Reserve would like to get inflation back down to 2%. I wanted to ask about that. As a consumer, we might think, I'd like inflation to be 0% so prices don't go up on stuff. It seems like it's generally seen as healthy to have that little bit of inflation year to year. Why is that?
Well, there are two reasons, Rob. The first thing is it's generally considered that the inflation rate You ready for this? It overstates the inflation rate. It okay. assumes essentially that you're buying the same things over and over, which is a good way to measure inflation. But in fact, when the price of something goes up, people tend to substitute into other things, which means their overall spending doesn't rise quite as fast as the rate of inflation. So one reason for it is when things are going up by 2%, the typical consumer doesn't really pay 2% more because they kind of stop buying some of the more expensive things. The second reason has to do with, as we talked about, the Fed raises interest rates to slow down the economy, slow down inflation. It lowers interest rates when it wants to stimulate the economy. So it raises interest rates typically when inflation is getting out of hand. It lowers interest rates when it thinks unemployment is too high. Now, it can't lower interest rates below zero. So it is generally considered there's a good idea to keep this 2% inflation rate that keeps normal interest rates above 2% and gives the Fed some room to cut interest rates by a few percent when they want to cut interest rates to stimulate the economy.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Rich is with us in Wanakee. Rich, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Talking to a non-economist here, but I have a question about the Inflation Reduction Act. So I had heard from another source that had some of that spending been more targeted, and I have a feeling that this is the way a lot of large government bills are maybe distributed, but does it matter if there's a large portion of a bill that's targeted, like specific to something versus like just a large bucket of money for something or some things? And I'll take my question or answer off the air. Thank you for your show.
Rich, thanks a lot for calling in. Yeah, the Inflation Reduction Act, like a lot of big federal government spending things, might say, here's some money for states to use as they see fit. Ultimately, Ken, does, the labeling, the bucketing of that money or not matter when it comes to inflation?
Well, sure. I'm afraid I couldn't be tell you the specifics about what might change in the Inflation Reduction Act to make it different. But the argument for the Inflation Reduction Act in terms of targeting was it was arguing that it was targeting certain investments that would pay off in the future. So the Congressional Budget Office, which is a nonpartisan agency that rates federal acts, estimated that the Inflation Reduction Act was going to reduce deficits by some $200 billion over the next 10 years. And you ask, how can spending reduce deficits? And the idea was it's going to be investment in new technologies that would pay off in the future. So yes, what it's aimed at matters. That act was intended to be aimed for things that would be good for inflation rather than bad for inflation. And again, good in the sense of it's investments that'll pay off in the future.
Thanks a lot for calling in with that question. Ken, I think the worry all along, with apart from inflation in and of itself, was that with these interest rate rises, the economy would slow down so much we might enter a recession. And so we might have good news, inflation's down to 2%. Bad news, unemployment's up to whatever, 9%. What are you looking at to see if that recession, that increase in unemployment is going to happen?
Well, that's an excellent point, Rob. That, in fact, historically, the Fed has never been able to get inflation substantially down without entering a recession. Now, there's always a first time for everything, so let's hope it's the first time right now. But a substantial reduction in inflation has historically in the U.S. always entailed a recession. Now, what's good news in terms of being cautiously optimistic about not entering a recession is, despite the interest rate hikes, the labor market is still looking good. The last unemployment rate was 3.5%, and that is a five-decade low. It has not been that low in 50 years. It's very slightly better than some unemployment rates we've had in the previous several years. So that's good. Consistent with that, the government collects data not only on unemployment, but on the flip side of job openings. And there are many more job openings than there are unemployed people. And that it would be highly, highly unusual in a recession. Now, the future is uncertain. Who knows what's going to happen? It could well be that while things look good now, Rob, you get back to me in 3 months and 6 months and say, what the heck? You said we can be cautiously optimistic. And look at that. Unemployment was 3.5%. Now it's 5.5%. That could happen. That could happen. So I would say we're kind of a 50-50 chance in terms of avoiding a recession, in terms of my own odds. I would say Wall Street prognosticators are mostly predicting a mild recession. Some think we can avoid it.
And Ken, in just our last minute or so, what are you watching for next to help answer some of these as yet unanswerable questions?
I would continue to look at, in terms of recession, continue to look at the labor market, continue to look at the unemployment rate, continue to look at the level of job openings relative to the unemployed. And on inflation, I think one should focus on this concept of core inflation, where you strip out the food, strip out the eggs and the gas, because that is something that tends to persist and not jump up and down from month to month. You can get a better idea of the trend by looking at core inflation. So core inflation, number one, and unemployment relative to job openings, number two.
Ken, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Rob. Thanks for having me on the show.
That's Kenneth West, the John D. MacArthur Professor of Economics at UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about inflation slowing down in the most recent numbers, what that could mean for consumers and for the economy as a whole. Coming up after the news, an expert on marijuana laws around the country joins us to look at the different ways states handle medicinal marijuana after Republican leaders say they're open to the idea in a limited fashion here in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, an astrophysicist explains how the recent breakthrough in fusion energy has allowed scientists to study stars and distant planets from inside a lab. Now, Republican State Senate Leader Devin Lemieux said earlier this month that members of his party are close to supporting a medical marijuana program in Wisconsin. It's the first time Senate leadership has opened the door to legalizing pot of any kind in the state. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss previously voiced his support for limited medicinal marijuana. Both Voss and Lemieux say any legalization would come with restrictions to limit the use of the drug to those with severe chronic medical conditions. 36 states have medical marijuana programs, including our neighbors Minnesota, Michigan, and Illinois. 21 states have fully legalized the drug. We're looking now at how other states handle the issue and the options available to Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see Wisconsin legalize medical marijuana? What conditions, what fine print would you want to see on that? If so, would you like to see the state legalize recreational marijuana, not currently on the table for leading Republicans in the state? Join in at 800-642-1234. And if you've experienced medical marijuana programs in other states around the country, love to hear your perspective on how that worked. 800-642-1234 is the number. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Alex Kreit is an assistant professor and director of the Center on Addiction Law and Policy at Northern Kentucky University. He's the author of the casebooks Illegal Drug and Marijuana Law and Marijuana Law and Policy. Alex, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Before we dig into Wisconsin here, can you give us a sense of the range of medical marijuana policies around the country?
Yeah, so, roughly speaking, there's kind of two categories. The first in the category that you talked about with the 36, I think now maybe even up to 37 states with full medical, that's medical marijuana that's not limited to what you call CBD only. So medical marijuana that would include THC-based kind of medical marijuana. Then there is another category of states that have what you would call CBD only types of laws, and those are much more restrictive. Within the, you know, sort of states with what many would refer to as sort of full medical marijuana programs, there's kind of a range as far as how restrictive they are in terms of the types of medical conditions that would qualify, whether physicians need to go through a particular kind of certification process or training to recommend medical marijuana. And then there are a few states that have some limitations on the types of medical cannabis that can be distributed, specifically limited things like pills or oils, gels, not allowing for sort of plant form medical marijuana to be distributed. Minnesota, as an example, used to have that kind of a limitation. I believe it was last year or the year before that they lifted that and extended it to plant form distribution.
All right, let's get to Wisconsin now. Here's State Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, Republican, talking last week on WPR's morning show about the kind of legalization he says he could get behind. Here's a listen.
I support a form of medical marijuana where it is very restricted, so it's only going to folks who have a true medical condition in a way that guarantees that we don't have any kind of being taken advantage of. So I think we could certainly try to find some consensus on medical marijuana, but the idea that Wisconsin needs to have recreational marijuana, I just don't support that.
Now, we don't have specific legislation to refer to now, but between that and the state Senate majority leader saying we're talking about like palliative care for cancer here, not like, you know, a routine back pain, things like that. Is that normal, Alex? Is that more stringent than you've seen medical marijuana laws in other states?
Yeah, I mean, I think that sounds like it would be on the more restrictive end for sure. And I, you know, the devil's in the details, right? So I think a lot will depend on what specific medical conditions that, you know, end up on the table. But I think it's fair to say that, you know, most medical marijuana states do have, you know, relatively broad, even in sort of more restrictive states. So, you know, it's not just limited to cancer patients or terminally ill patients. You know, there's MS, epilepsy, Crohn's disease, PTSD, you know, chronic pain. Those are relatively, you know, common medical conditions that in most medical marijuana states. So, you know, I think if it was to be limited, you know, just to cancer, to terminal illness, those kinds of things, that would be very, very restrictive relative to other states. You know, but again, you know, it will depend, I guess, on exactly what is proposed.
And Speaker Voss, they're referring to the idea, I think, that a medical marijuana system could be taken advantage of by people really using it for recreational purposes. How have states that have, you know, more or less full medical legislation but not recreational, how have they tried to thread that needle?
Yeah, and I think there's been a, you know, range of approaches and kind of outlooks. I think some states, certainly historically, California would be an example of this. I think there's some states that, you know, sort of accepted that there would be people who, you know, might be using medical marijuana and might, you know, get a medical marijuana recommendation primarily for what we would consider recreational use. And, you know, there wasn't, you know, I think in some states, and again, California before full legalization in that state is an example of this. You know, didn't really attempt to crack down, didn't, you know, try to limit that too much. I think just kind of accepted that, you know, as kind of a, you know, better to do that than to be too restrictive or too limiting in preventing people with genuine medical need. I think more and more states, you know, have attempted to, you know, address that through things like limiting it to specific medical conditions. Some states have tried to, you know, have been maybe more skeptical of medical conditions like pain conditions that, you know, some argue or some believe could be more likely to be, you know, where patients could, you know, as that quote said, quote unquote, take advantage of it. You know, conditions where, it's based more on self-reporting from the patient. So, you know, there've been certainly, I think, a range of approaches to addressing it and a range of kind of outlooks as far as, you know, how much of a concern the state believes that to be. You know, does the state think that It's, you know, necessary to really prioritize trying to, you know, limit as much as possibly can be limited to people with a legitimate medical need, or is the state willing to accept some possibility, some potential, some number of patients who don't have that legitimate medical need, nevertheless being able to get access by feigning medical need? And our state, some states, I think, are willing to accept, you know, that possibility to a degree to have a broader, more comprehensive medical cannabis program.
We're talking to Alex Kreit, professor and director of the Center on Addiction Law and Policy at Northern Kentucky University. Look at the ways states around the country handle medical marijuana. Wisconsin's Republican legislative leaders have recently said they are close to supporting medical marijuana here for a limited number of medical conditions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want the state to legalize medical marijuana? How stringent do you want requirements to be? If so, a narrow number of cases or more generally available to people who have a perceived need for it? Do you want to go full recreational here in the state? Have you encountered medicinal marijuana in other states? What did you think about how it was handled there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Alex Kreit, professor at Northern Kentucky University, expert on marijuana law and drug policy, looking at the issue of medical marijuana in Wisconsin after Republican leaders say they could support legalizing it here in pretty limited cases. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What, if anything, do you want to change when it comes to Wisconsin's laws on marijuana? Do you have questions about how other states handle particular issues or experiences in those states? Call 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Mike is with us in northern Wisconsin. Mike, hi.
Hi, I think it's about time that Wisconsin does what 36, I believe, other states have done, and I'd like to take it one step further. Oregon and New York have just legalized the use of psilocybin for treatment-resistant depression, and I think the number of veterans in this country who are depressed and high suicide rate should be also on the table here. I think that would be a very good way of reducing suicide from PTSD. And John Hopkins University has done research that indicates that it's very, very reliable.
Mike, thanks for that call. Alex, the psilocybin, I think probably a taller lift for Wisconsin, but are you seeing a trend for more states looking in that direction as well? Alex, are you there? We're not hearing our guest, Alex Kreit from Northern Kentucky University, looking at marijuana policy, how it's handled around the country. Thanks a lot for that call and sharing your perspective on that. We'll keep taking your calls in the meantime. Hopefully we'll get our guest back in just a moment. We'll go to Jay now in Two Rivers. Jay, hello.
Yes, good afternoon. I hope you're having a good MLK day.
You too, Jay. What did you want to bring up?
Well, the Republican in the state of Wisconsin didn't get on board with helping those addicted to opiates until their children started dying off. And we're so far behind that it's just embarrassing and disappointing that the Republican state legislators think that they have the knowledge to override what trained medical professionals and doctors might know. And I think we should go for complete decriminalization. Thank you.
Jay, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Alex, I think we have you back. Jay saying he thinks Republican lawmakers in Wisconsin a little behind the curve. Can you talk about how Wisconsin stacks up in terms of marijuana legalization timelines with other states in the Midwest and beyond?
Yeah, sure thing. And sorry about the tech glitch. My computer
decided
it was a time to suddenly do a restart. So, yeah, I mean, I think that Wisconsin really is, you know, behind the curve. I mean, you just have to look at nothing other than how many states have legalized medical marijuana to see that, right? That, you know, if you have a vast, you know, substantial majority that have legalized medical marijuana, and it's, you know, including some quite conservative states, Alabama, Mississippi recently enacted medical marijuana legislation. So, you know, it is something that, you know, kind of spans partisan, you know, profiles among the states. So it is, you know, in a state like Wisconsin, obviously neighboring states have it. So it's, it is, you know, something where, frankly, to me, I've always been a little struck by the fact that it hasn't gotten done in Wisconsin, especially as we've seen more and more states and some quite conservative states where it has gotten done.
Thanks for that call. Now, Wisconsin's Medical Society wrote a letter on a previous bill saying, hang on, we're opposing medical marijuana because a lot of the medicinal uses of marijuana, they're not really tested, not really proven yet. Have you seen that reaction from medical organizations in other states as they go through these arguments?
Yeah, I think in different states, there's kind of been a range of reactions as far as how supportive medical organizations have been state by state. You know, we're in some more supportive than others. I think, you know, the issue with research has always been, you know, kind of a core point of debate and of challenge for medical marijuana. And it's frankly sort of, I think, one of the things that led this to be a state level type of reform, which is that it has been historically very, very, very difficult to conduct research into the medical uses of marijuana, in part because of its, you know, really completely because of its Schedule I status under federal law. And so these federal barriers to research, that's been sort of one of the things that drove state-level medical marijuana reform in the first place, was that there was a lot of evidence of promise of medical uses of marijuana, a lot of evidence of, you know, actual medical value of the use of medical marijuana. But it was very difficult to conduct the kind of research that you would need to go through an FDA approval process, for example.
Let's go back to our callers. Pauly is with us in Argyle. Pauly, hi.
Hey, how you doing? I totally agree with this, with your person on today. I have suffered from chronic pain for 25 years, and my doctor has told me for the last 20 years that if it were legal, she would prescribe it in a heartbeat. So it's pretty sad when American has to move from their state they live in to another state if they want to get that help. And obviously I'm not going to do it because I love Wisconsin. But, you know, so I have to kind of deal with things in my own way, which makes me feel like I'm a criminal. You know, I'm 65 years old. You know, I'm not a criminal. I just don't want to live in dire pain all the time.
Pauly, sorry to hear about your long-term chronic pain. Thank you for sharing your story, Alex. I think Pauly, not alone. We get tests, or we hear callers, and there's testimony in state legislatures around the country with similar stories just in the last minute or so.
Oh, yeah, certainly. And, you know, I recently served on a state commission in Kentucky, which doesn't yet have a medical marijuana program, and I teach at Northern Kentucky University, and part of serving that commission, we ran around the state, held listening sessions, and heard from a lot of folks just like that caller who suffer from pain or other medical conditions, don't want to leave the state, love where they live, but don't want to be branded as a criminal, want to have access to the medicine that can help them with their ailment.
And just in our last few moments, you're watching there in Kentucky, here in Wisconsin, other states that you are keeping a close eye on right now.
You know, for recreational, Ohio, you know, not just because of where I'm located, but, you know, that's, I think, a state that looks poised to have legalization on the ballot this year, 2023, and I think is likely to have it passed.
Alex, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Alex Kreit, assistant professor and director of the Center on Addiction Law and Policy at Northern Kentucky University. He talked to us today about how states around the country handle medical marijuana programs. Thanks for your calls. If there's something you'd like to hear more about on this issue on Central Time or elsewhere on WPR, let us know about it. Email ideas@WPR.org with your questions. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a dream about hibernation.
Some animals hibernate to survive the winter. Humans aren't included in that group, but that hasn't stopped writer Krista Eastman from imagining her perfect winter abode.
Before natural historians understood that some birds fly thousands of miles south each winter, they looked for other ways to explain their disappearance. Birds were like snakes, they suggested, burrowing for themselves a hibernaculum, an earthy pocket in which to pass the winter. Under the ground, the robin slumbered, her heart beating once in a while, her open throat not tweeting at all, her feathers caked in grit. This was another way to survive the winter, digging in, admitting no one, waiting for this too to pass. Deep into the winter blues, I awake to early morning darkness and wonder, is there really no other place for people and animals to live? Is there no other way? Some people are practical in coping with the season. Swift in booking cheap flights to Florida, they do not hesitate, they do not dally, they just depart. I am a member of that other tribe, those who dig in, those who let their thoughts grow warped on the grayest light of winter. At some point, usually around January 14th, I surrender to the season. My most insignificant problems begin to appear to me as uncontainable irritations, crosswords I'm much too grumpy to solve. It's hard, then, not to fantasize about my own hibernaculum, how I'd stock mine with a 5-month supply of coffee, chocolate, cheese, and wine to be consumed in that order every day, all winter long. Add to that a pile of books and a landline that only dials out for delivery. This would be the season of slow and silent contemplation, moderate melancholy, little to no exercise. A wise friend of mine claims this is what winter is for, a natural slowing down, a time to reflect, a not-so-unhealthy space for feeling a little bit sad. If it were possible, I think I'd also loft my hibernaculum in a tree and make of it a warm and protected nest. And then I'd also probably appoint someone responsible for yanking open the nest trap door once spring had truly come. I'd fall to the ground in an unwashed heap, stand up, blink my eyes. I imagined then that my pitying neighbors would gather round to watch as I stood for the first time in months, stretching muscles, cracking joints. She smells even worse than last year, one of them might mutter, as I crab walk off to the lake for a bracing spring rinse. But I won't do any of that, of course, not really. I will climb out of bed when my son wakes each morning. I will be on time for work. I will remember to bring home that carton of eggs. But someday I will also emerge vainglorious from winter's pocket. It will be suddenly warm, and I will be suddenly awake, and soon, my naked ankles frisky from sun, I'll wonder, what could be better than here? What way is there but this?
Krista Eastman's essays have appeared in the Georgia Review, the Kenyon Review, and other journals. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit our website at wisconsinlife.org and find us on Facebook and on Twitter. I'm Maureen McCollum.
There are lots of great Wisconsin Life stories up at wisconsinlife.org right now, including an investigation of the Trolls of Mount Horeb by Central Times' own Tim Peterson. Head over there and find out why that Wisconsin community is the troll capital of the world. It's got some cool pictures of the trolls, too. Find it online at wisconsinlife.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, some Wisconsin communities are pushing back against the large-scale livestock farms, often called CAFOs. But their authority in many cases is limited by state law. Find out why local governments can and can't do and why that is, and meet one community where this is a big issue. And if you have questions or if this is something facing your community, we'd love to hear from you. You can get the conversation started right now via email. email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org with your questions or experiences. Then tune in tomorrow morning at 7. That's here on the Ideas Network. Every Friday, we talk about food here on Central Time in a segment we creatively call Food Friday. A lot of times, I take what I heard on Food Friday and put it into action right away. Like last Friday, we talked about salad with the author of a new cookbook called Salad Freak. And on Friday night, fresh out of that salad conversation, I went right home and grilled some brats. Okay, so it didn't match up, but yesterday, my wife made a lunch and we need a little something to go with it, so I made a salad. I followed our guest's advice on how to wash the lettuce. You totally immerse it in the water in the salad spinner, then drain it, then spin it dry. And I made my own dressing like she recommended. Super simple. Olive oil, fresh squeezed lemon juice, bit of soy sauce, salt, and pepper. Looked for a special ingredient in the fridge. We had a jar of capers, but they smelled really bad. They were like 8 months past date. I threw them out. We did have some grapes. I cut thin slices, tossed them on top of the dressed greens. We still have some fancier salad recipes up at wpr.org/centraltime. It's food news I can use. This is Central Time.